This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 300 was recorded on December 2nd, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. We wanted to bring you a credible disinflationist to keep the secular inflation debate going for our 300th episode, and they don't come much more credible than David Rosenberg. Rosie will describe the reasons the inflation we've already seen has occurred and why he doesn't think it will last. We'll also discuss stock prices, bond yields, and precious metals. Then be sure to stay tuned for our postgame segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled Correction or Crash.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's get to this S&P 500. Man, how much has changed in a week? Last week, we were looking at the market trading up around the 4,700 level. And here we now find ourselves in a week later with a 5%, 250-point S&P correction of some sort. And I want to talk about it a little bit in the postgame. But what's your take on what's going on?
Patrick, I think the entire move in both stocks and particularly in crude oil has been an overdone, exaggerated reaction to a scare about the Omicron strain of the coronavirus. And for those people actually paying attention, there's really not that much to be concerned about. Yes, it's an unknown, and yes, anything is possible. But one of the possibilities that credible virologists are actually discussing is that it could be that the Omicron strain is more transmissible. It has a very, very high R-naught, close to 6, they believe. But it may be much less deadly and much less dangerous, which means it could be a blessing in disguise. We could actually see a less dangerous strain. That's the new Omicron strain, if it proves to be less dangerous. We don't know that yet. It could crowd out the Delta strain and actually lead to the end of the pandemic. So there are both good and bad outcomes that are possible. It's not known yet, and I think everybody has basically priced in the maximum bad. Now, it could be that we really do have maximum bad here, and the world is ending and the sky is falling. I don't think that's likely to be the case, Patrick. I think that Omicron is overblown. If I think back to what it felt like during the entire month of February, waiting for the market to figure out what we had already discussed in January was pretty obviously coming, which was a global pandemic. Feels kind of the opposite to me. It feels like everybody is panicking now when really the people who are paying attention can see that there's not a lot of good reason for it. So we put in the correction to the 50-day moving average on the S&P. Is that going to be it? I think probably, unless there's more rhetoric and more bad decisions out of Washington, D.C. regarding this Omicron strain, which, based on the information we have so far, does not warrant the amount of hype and hoopla that's been put into it.
Eric, let's touch on that dollar index.
Patrick, we tested 97, still holding 96. The trend looks strong to me.
All right, well, let's touch on where the real action was with crude oil. And boy, did things really escalate after we recorded last week's episode. What's your take on this monstrous drop in oil?
Patrick, it's all about panic over the Omicron strain, and I don't think that panic is justified. And of course, it's also being driven by the SPR decision. And then we had OPEC today announcing that they would stay the course on their intention to increase output. The way I'm interpreting this is I think OPEC was smart enough not to play into the White House's game. They were being set up as scapegoats. If OPEC had paused, then the White House would have announced that Joe Biden had solved the gas prices at the pump problem, but then OPEC sabotaged it. So they didn't play into being set up as patsies that way, is the way that I'm reading this. I think they probably should have paused because their job is to stabilize prices, and prices have dropped at a level that just does not jibe with fundamentals as far as I'm concerned. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens next. Has the oil market finally bottomed? There was a big dump in reaction to OPEC standing pat, which promptly retraced almost completely, although it looks like we're starting to trade back down now as we're speaking just after 1 o'clock on Thursday afternoon. So it'll be interesting to see where we close. We're still below the 200-day moving average. Getting back above the 200-day would be the first step towards maybe saying that this route is over. So I don't know if the final bottom is in yet, but I do think that this market has sold off much more than it should.
Eric, any update on the inventory numbers?
Crude oil drawing down 910,000 barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma building 1.2 million barrels. And then the big builds were on gasoline and distillates. Gasoline, 4 million barrels, distillates, 2.2 million barrels, both builds. U.S. production ticking up to 11.6 million barrels. That's up 100,000 from last week's report. Boy, you know, a lot of people told me that it was absolutely impossible for the U.S. to ever get back to its previous record of 13 million barrels of production. Well, we're not there yet, but we're trending in the right direction. Be interesting to see how this plays out.
All right, well, let's touch on gold, because gold throughout this whole period has continued to just weaken. I mean, we're not breaking any major lows or anything, but certainly it's not been bid. What's your take on gold here?
Well, on the day that both Janet Yellen and Jay Powell agreed that they should drop the word transitory when talking about inflation, we see gold really struggling and plumbing new lows here, at least in the last couple of weeks, suggesting that was a false breakout that we had and maybe a setup for a move substantially lower. It's really hard to make sense of this market, Patrick, but the overwhelming comment I have is, you know, a lot of people predicted what's going to happen is they're going to debase the currency and there's going to be inflation and gold is going to the moon. Well, we got the debasement, we got the inflation, gold is not going to the moon. So we need to ask ourselves, why is it that gold's not doing what we expected it to do when the predictions that we made came true, which they have come true? The only thing I can come up with, Patrick, is that cryptocurrency is competing for market share and taking away from the demand for gold, for the investor demand for gold. If there's another explanation, I haven't found it yet.
All right, now let's just wrap up with touching on the 10-year Treasury yield, which in typical risk-off fashion, the yield dropped almost 25 basis points in the last week as bonds have rallied. Anything that you see going on in the bond market?
Well, I'm going to discuss this at length with David Rosenberg, so I don't want to steal his thunder. Let's save most of the bond yield discussion for Rosie in the feature interview.
All right. Well, this week's feature interview guest is David Rosenberg. And Eric, why did we get Rosie on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, as we titled the episode, he is one of the last deflationists standing. Dr. Lacey Hunt is the other one. We're trying to get him on the show as well. I wanted to get a credible response. We're going back and forth between Jeff Snyder was deflation camp, then Lynn Alden and the inflation camp. I wanted to continue to get as many credible voices as we can find on both sides of the argument. So it's really great to hear from David, and I think you're going to really enjoy this interview.
Eric's interview with David Rosenberg is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is David Rosenberg, founder of Rosenberg Research. Rosie, it's great to have you back on the show. Last time we spoke, it wasn't in vogue yet to be talking about inflation. Only a few people were. You told us inflation was coming, but don't be fooled. It's going to be transitory. Let's get an update. Is that still your view? And what is your outlook? Are you concerned at all about secular inflation?
Well, the last part is easy to answer. So absolutely not at all concerned about secular inflation. And it's very interesting. I was asked those questions after Barack Obama got elected, and I got asked it again after Donald Trump got elected. And there are no new eras. One of Bob Farrell's fabled 10 market rules to remember. No new eras. There is no new inflation era, despite what you hear. And I would just say that the fundamental forces in place for the past three decades that have ensured that inflation remained on a fundamental downtrend line were the three Ds: demographics, debt, and disruptive technology. And it doesn't mean that we don't have gyrations around that trend line. We had a gigantic gyration around that trend line, you know, in the 2000s when I was at Mother Merrill. And oil prices, if you remember, went to $150 a barrel, and inflation got to the same levels that they're at today. And everybody believed back then that we were in some permanently new commodity super cycle inflation era. And I asked the question, how well did that turn out? So I would say that, you know, for the time being, certainly inflation is going to remain sticky because of the supply chain issues. People talk about booming demand. That, to me, is in the rearview mirror. I don't think we have booming demand anymore. And a lot of the durable goods purchases by the American consumer has already been facilitated. If there's going to be strength in spending, it'll come more on the services side, which is still lower today than it was before the pandemic. So speaking of the pandemic, that's really where the inflation is coming from. And it's principally from supply side issues that the Fed or any other central bank has little control over. But I don't believe for a second that supply chains are broken indefinitely. And I do believe that we are going to have a situation where, and you're seeing it in the commodity markets already, where the goods inflation morphs into goods deflation a year from now that's not on the market. And I guess if transitory to you is, you know, a few days, weeks, months, or even quarters, then certainly it's not transitory. If you go to the Webster's definition of transitory, there's no timeline attached to it. And Jay Powell has thrown in the towel on this. I haven't. Because transitory to me means something that isn't permanent or something that's short term. And in the overall scheme of things, from a, you know, from an economic history standpoint, we will not be talking about this as a major secular inflationary period any more than we remember what happened in the mid-2000s when we had that massive commodity super cycle. Nobody seems to remember that, but we were talking about inflation back then too. So I'm fading the consensus narrative on this. I think the economy is going to slow precipitously next year because of the fiscal withdrawal. I think that, God willing, we'll get through the pandemic without any more variants along the way, but that could be wishful thinking. But the supply chains will come back. Globalization is not dead. And we will go back to where we were before, which was an inflation environment that'll be roughly 2%. I don't see that deviating.
Now, I'm curious, when you referred to Jay Powell throwing in the towel, were you referring to his comments in the course of testimony before the Congress on Tuesday of this week, same day that we're speaking? And how do you interpret that? Why do you think the Fed made that statement?
Well, look, it's not the first time we've seen Jay Powell pivot. It's called the Powell pivot for a reason, because he was talking extremely hawkishly and actually raising rates in the fourth quarter 2018. And then the stock market collapses 20%. Some stocks are down 30 to 40%. The credit markets froze. We didn't have a high yield bond issue for a couple of months, and the yield curve flattened. And next thing you know, the Fed's cutting rates three times in 2019. I mean, you got to go back to the last few months of 2018, and rate cuts were nowhere on Jay Powell's mind. And yet in 2019, in the context of coming off an epic trillion-dollar tax cut by President Trump, we had three Fed rate cuts. So once again, we have a pivot. I mean, when you go back to Jay Powell's speech that he gave at Jackson Hole in late August. You know, it wasn't a few years ago. He gave a bellwether speech on the fundamental forces driving inflation down. He seems to have abandoned that. And I think because he's under a lot of pressure, he's under a lot of political pressure. And ultimately, you know, who was his boss is Congress, but he was reappointed by Biden. And I believe he has some sort of political responsibility because the Fed is a political institution when push comes to shove. It is the construct of the Federal Reserve Act by Congress. So to say that the Fed has independence, I've always sort of chuckled at that. But I think in this case, he's really changed abruptly. And I would say no doubt that the inflation situation has proven to have been more cumbersome than even I would have thought, or anybody for that matter. But usually a central bank chairperson has a very big picture view and doesn't allow a few weekly or monthly wiggles in the data, gyrations around the trend line is what I call them, influence your view. I mean, if you remember, go back to Alan Greenspan back in the 1990s, he was steadfast in the view that we were in a situation of rampant technology, the internet, and that productivity was going to keep inflation low with strong growth. And he didn't feel he had to raise interest rates, and he didn't, and he was right. But he didn't let monthly or quarterly wiggles influence his fundamental view. And I'm finding right now that Jay Powell seems to have been pushed off his fundamental view. It's hard to believe that so much has happened to push him off a fundamental view as much as what's happened in the past couple of months. But let's take a look at what's happened in the past couple of months. And I'm not talking about inflation. I'm talking about Joe Biden's approval rating has fallen through the floor. And Biden is getting blamed for a lot of this inflation. Most of it actually is beyond his control. Some of it is within his control, but that's because he chose to undergo a massive fiscal stimulus package back in March at a time when the economy was reopening, and that exacerbated the inflationary situation. But you see, Biden needs to have Powell sound very tough on inflation right now. He needs that to help his credibility and to show the public that the government is going to be fighting inflation, since the view is that the reason why Biden's popularity is so low is because of this inflation run-up. And of course, you know, it's not really called inflation, it's called screwflation, because most of the things that are going up in price the most are the things that hit low and middle-income households the hardest, and especially when you consider food and energy and the most visible items in the CPI. So I think a lot of this is politics, in my opinion, and why Powell all of a sudden has taken a more hawkish course. I would still be very surprised, unless this latest variant turns out to be a flash in the pan, that the Fed, they may go ahead with the taper, but I have a tough time believing they're hiking interest rates 3 or 4 times next year.
That was actually going to be my next question, because Jay Powell did allude to accelerating the pace of tapering and several hikes in 2022. So do you think that was just political posturing? Doesn't really mean it?
No, I think there's a real push within the FOMC to speed up the taper. And they should have actually done that already. I mean, the Bank of Canada north of the border has already ended their QE. The Fed decided to do it in stages. The QE had little impact on the economy. When you go to the last cycle under Bernanke, the QE had little impact on the economy. Its impact really is on financial assets. So all the Fed has done is just made fat cats richer by stimulating financial asset inflation. And you could actually argue housing inflation. So that's the problem. The problem here is that the Fed should have started tapering earlier. And frankly, you know, let them taper. They're still buying mortgage-backed securities. For what reason? Home prices are up 20% year over year. Wannabe homeowner households who are renting have been crowded out of the market because of the insanity on pricing. And part of that is because of QE. And the Fed, once again, has created a fairly large equity bubble as well. Because even when you normalize for interest rates, the price earnings multiple is so inflated. I mean, you have a CAPE PE of 40, which has only happened 2% of the time in the past 130 years. It's a like a 5-standard deviation event. And so the Fed has once again created, as they've done so many times in the past, they created the conditions for a bubble that now has to deflate. The sooner they do that, the better. But when we're talking about taper, that's one thing. That's about financial assets. That's about the Fed has your back. And that's just not going to be around for investors anymore. Rate hikes are something different. Rate hikes will have a meaningful impact on Main Street, which is why I don't think that we'll see the rate hike expectations priced into the Treasury curve coming to fruition. And you're starting to see already, just in the past several days, those rate hike expectations coming out of the market. I just think that there's more to go. In fact, I don't even think the Fed will be raising rates at all next year. And it won't be because they don't want to. It's because I don't think the economy will give them the cover to do that. And tremendous opportunity in the rates market, Eurodollar futures, Fed fund contracts, the Treasury curve, anything that's priced for what the Fed, what the market thinks the Fed's going to do next year, that's really what you want to buy.
Let's talk about what this means for the stock market, because normally if we're talking about disinflation, we're talking about an economy that's going to be in trouble. You know, these are all stock market down kind of signals. But lately it seems like, perhaps due to Fed supplied liquidity, the stock market seems to have this ability to just melt up through almost anything. Is that going to turn around? Are we going to see a meaningful correction or even a cyclical bear market here?
Well, you know, the market has received 3 major tailwinds since coming off the lows in March of 2020. It had a dramatic monetary tailwind, and then it had a dramatic fiscal tailwind, and then it had a dramatic vaccine tailwind. I mean, nobody thought early on that we would ever see a vaccine within 5 years. And of course, we have to pay attention to the fact that the pandemic is not in the rearview mirror, but we do have vaccines. The medical science staying ahead of this or staying in line with it. And notwithstanding what's happening right now, we have to believe that we did ultimately get through Delta. We'll get through this, but it is going to be a problem, I think, from an uncertainty and volatility standpoint for the next several months. I don't tend to base my investment advice based on events, as we're seeing right now with this latest variant. I just stick to the fundamentals. And so what do I see next year? I'm not saying we're going to have a recession, but you don't need to have a recession to have a significant pullback in the stock market. Just go back, as I said before, to the fourth quarter of 2018. There was no recession. That was no walk in the park. And in fact, you had 3 years in that great cycle from 2009 to 2019. There were 3 years where the stock market really didn't make you any money. It doesn't go up every year. You know, the problem I have is that there's this expectation now that it will go up every year just because of what happened, you know, coming off the pandemic lows. That's not the way the world works. My big concern is valuations. And people will always say, well, but valuations are not a timing tool. And they're not a timing tool. But I never advertised to anybody that I was a market timer. This starting point on the multiple is a huge constraint on future returns. In fact, when you're over 40 on the CAPE multiple, and it doesn't mean you go into recession. It's just about classic Bob Farrell rule number one, mean reversion. In the 2% of the time in the past 130 years that the multiple was this high, the 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year returns for the S&P 500 were negative. That's all I'm saying. So I don't have a recession forecast next year. I just have a situation where we have an unusually expensive stock market. There's a lot priced in. And there is a risk that the Fed is going to make a policy mistake. And the only way you can justify equity valuations as to where they are right now is through interest rates. But even more to the point, when you normalize interest rates and you look at equity valuations, we're still 15% overvalued. You know, it used to be people said, oh, well, we can justify these multiples because look where interest rates are. That was true 9 or 12 months ago. We've way superseded that. I'm very concerned about what's priced in. I see all the classic signs of a bubble. I see it in leverage. We have margin debt up more than 40% in the past year, heading to $1 trillion for the first time. I mentioned the valuations. Sentiment is off the charts. market positioning, I mean, you go to the latest big money Barron's poll of portfolio managers, they are all in, 68% asset mix in favor of the equity market. It really doesn't get much bigger than that. And then we have portfolio managers, when you go to the ICI data, sitting on 2% cash ratios. Razor thin. And of course, we got the data from the from Bank of America, my alma mater, just the other day, showing that through so far this year, there's been $900 billion of money flowing into equity ETFs and mutual funds, which is as much as what's been collected in the past 19 years combined. So you also have massive, if not unprecedented, retail participation. These are all the classic signs of a bubble, whether it's sentiment, market positioning, valuation, leverage. And so notwithstanding the economic environment, I am actually pretty worried that anything that causes a mean reversion trade is going to push us into a steep correction. And I think there's a good chance that'll happen next year. And my big concern, because I don't have a big inflation view, but the Fed seems to have moved in that direction, they start to move rates up, we're in a whole new situation altogether. So the monetary tailwinds that cause people to buy every dip because the Fed had your back, well, my theme is that the Fed doesn't have your back next year. And we're not going to get fiscal stimulus next year. It's not happening. In fact, the amount of fiscal withdrawal next year is going to be roughly 2.5 percentage points of GDP. And yet I don't see that in many forecasters' numbers for next year. We had, you know, how's the economy held in? We had the amount of fiscal stimulus this year gave the economy a 5% boost. Now we're going to get some of that infrastructure next year, but it's not going to be enough to offset what's happening in the vacuum from fiscal policy. It's going to be a huge drag next year. Nobody talks about it. So the fiscal tailwinds are over. The monetary tailwinds are over. It doesn't look like the pandemic is over. And so I think that for next year, it's going to be a little problematic. The big risk to me, if you can ask me what the big risk is, and there are numerous risks, is that the Fed pulls a classic policy misstep and decides to follow the market and follow the pressure in the media and start to raise interest rates.
Let's talk about commodities. The secular inflation crowd is saying, hey, it's a new commodity super cycle because of the inflation, and it's set to continue. I'm guessing since you don't share the inflation view, that you probably see commodities as kind of rich to value here.
Well, I think that there are, you can point to really a handful of commodities that, you know, are in a, we'll have a secular bull market. Related to the greening of the world and electric vehicles and the like. But, you know, I'm taking a look just now, you know, people are talking about inflation, about commodities. I mean, if you want to go, you know, if you want to focus on, you know, maybe you want to focus on copper or natural gas or hydrogen or those sorts of things. And we've actually constructed an index of secular commodities. They're a handful. But I'm just looking at the data, and everybody's talking about commodity inflation. Meanwhile, from the recent peaks, iron ore is down 60%, lumber is down 50%, steel prices are down 25%, soybeans are down 25%, corn is down 20%, all of a sudden oil is down 20%, and the base metals in the aggregate are down 12%. And then people come back and say, oh, lumber's down 50%, but only after rising, you know, 100%. And I say, well, do the math on that, because usually you go up 100% and then you're down 50%. You're back to where you were. That's exactly what's happened. It's called bear market math. If you go down 100%, you're at zero. And I got people saying, oh, well, but you're saying we're down 50% when we were before up 100%. Yeah. Exactly.
I won't comment on the ability of people in the finance business to understand arithmetic, but your point is well taken, sir.
but commodities are rolling over. I mean, up until the last couple of days, the dollar had been strengthening. Of course, the dollar's given it up a little bit because of these receding Fed tightening expectations for next year. But I've seen, look, the thing about goods inflation, nothing's permanent here, and it just moves in a cycle. I think this time next year, the 40% of the CPI called goods is going to be negative. It ain't going to be positive. Service sector will be a little stickier, admittedly. There's going to be all sorts of cross currents. But the thing is that the dominant impact on the service sector side is, of course, imputed rents and actual rents. And that's going to be problematic from my view for the next few months. But I'm looking at the data, and this is the reality of a free market enterprise economy, is that high prices will attract supply. And maybe this is something that has nothing to do with global supply chains, and nor should it. But I'm just noticing that when you take a look at multifamily building permits, housing starts, units under construction and completions, they're booming. The number of rental units under construction right now in the United States is at the highest level in 45 years. And there's a lag here, but it's telling me that the supply response in the second half of next year will be overwhelming. The vacancy rate will go back up and rental rates will come back down, just as the lagged impacts of what I just mentioned on commodities is going to filter through to the goods part of the CPI. I think inflation is going to melt in the second half of next year. Now, for a lot of people, that's just too long because, you know, you speak to most people today, they're so tempestuous. Long-term to them is lunch tomorrow. But I'm saying that you have a lot of inflation priced into the bond curve. I mean, you've got almost 3% inflation break-evens in the five-year treasury note. You got 3 to 4 rate hikes priced in for next year. And based on my forecast on the economy and on inflation, none of that's going to happen. And that's why it tells me to be bullish on the treasury market. And actually, for all the talk about what a horrible year this has been for the treasury market, yields peaked at the end of March. It's actually been terrific ever since. We've not hit it, despite all the horrific inflation and all the bond bears out there, as vocal as they could be, and we have almost a record net speculative short position on the CBOT and the 10-year note. It's incredible. And so what do you do for an encore? So I think we're going to go through a bull flattening, which has already started. And that tells me, as far as investing is concerned, well, you want to be long the longest duration bond, the 30-year treasury. But I would also say that bond proxies should do well. And I think within the equity market, if I'm long only equity, I want to be in defensive growth. Do not want to be in cyclicals. I think the consumer is going to fade next year. There's no pent-up demand on the good side. And I think that if you're going to be in the equity market writ large, defensive growth, you know, that means it could mean parts of technology, healthcare, consumer staples, and dare I say utilities. Utilities, by the way, which are the most detested and underowned sector of the stock market, but that's because of its high correlation with the treasury market. That's why everybody despises it so much, because they despise the bond market and they don't understand the bond market. But you're not buying the bond market for the coming year on yield. You're buying it on price, because if I'm right on this narrative, the total return will be very significant, at least 10% at the long end of the curve.
So the play there is price appreciation on the expectation of declining yields on the 30-year. How far down do you think the 30-year yield can go?
Well, you know, we're already down to 180, if I'm not mistaken. And I think the 10-year will get down to 1%. And I think that the long bond will get down to, call it, roughly 130, 135.
David, let's move on to precious metals, a subject that's near and dear to many of our listeners' hearts. What do you see going on there?
Well, I actually think that that if there's going to be a year for gold, 2022 is going to be the year. For one, I think that a lot of these interest rate expectations that are priced in, that have caused the U.S. dollar to snap back in the past several months, that's going to unwind. And so since gold's priced in U.S. dollars, it's the perfect hedge against the U.S. dollar. I think that's going to be a tailwind. On top of that, if I'm right that a lot of these rate expectations dissipate, bond yields come down, and we have to remember again that gold is inversely correlated to bond yields, because the opportunity cost of holding gold goes down as bond yields go down, well, that's going to be another very important tailwind for gold. But there's a third one, which is what's happening on the geopolitical side. And we have to keep an eye on China more than ever, especially with what's perceived to be a weak administration on foreign policy, and Xi Jinping more powerful than he's ever been before. And we have to watch China and its ambitions. We have to watch what that means for Taiwan, which I think we'll see more in the news. And I don't think we'll go into a war with China. That's not going to happen in a classic sense, but economic warfare, cyber warfare, there's going to be that sort of a warfare. I think that tensions with China are going to accelerate. And gold should, once again, be that classic geopolitical hedge. You could say to me, well, you know, wouldn't Bitcoin or crypto also serve that purpose? But you see, the thing is that gold is a safe haven, and it does not have extraordinary volatility, but crypto does. And so for all the people that talk about crypto and how you value it is really anybody's guess. It's really just a momentum gauge. That's all crypto is. It's a momentum gauge. It is the poster child of the risk-on trade. That's all crypto is. And so I think next year is going to be the inverse of the risk-on trade. I think that next year will be the risk-off trade. And I think that crypto and Bitcoin will have a tougher time of it next year. Out of everything I said, I talked about defensive growth. I talked about utilities. I talked about the treasury market, talked about gold. Next year will be the year of mean reversion, where safety valves come back into vogue, where capital preservation, which has been lost among the investment masses, capital preservation never goes out of style, but there's a belief that it has, but it hasn't. That'll be a theme next year. Safe haven investing, capital preservation, and the era that we've had unusually, and I think this is maybe the market gods have been testing our resolve and our discipline, but throwing caution to the wind, which has worked so well in the past 2 years, I expect that too will be mean reverting in 2022.
David, with respect to crypto, I personally agree with you. I think the fundamental argument for gold is better, but you know, there's a lot of people who disagree with us. What does that mean just in terms of market share? It seems to me like one of the reasons gold hasn't performed so well here is that a lot of people who used to buy gold under these circumstances have decided that they think it makes more sense to buy crypto. When you see crypto maybe having a washout next year, does that mean that money flows into gold?
I think that will probably happen. I mean, there's other reasons why I'm bullish on gold. I am not in the higher interest rate camp. If I was, I'd be bearish on gold. I'm in the lower bond yield camp. That view is now, actually not just now, but the past little while, been working out very well. I am not a bull on the US dollar. And so that's going to be something that helps out. The crypto call is just because, for no other reason, it's just so highly correlated with the risk on trade. So if I had a risk on trade for next year, I'd have a high beta portfolio. I'd say, sure, you know, go buy Bitcoin or go buy crypto. Sure. But I just know, if I know anything about the crypto space, and I'm not talking about the technology of it, I'm just saying, you know, yeah, people are saying that we've been wrong and missed out on this other bubble, but you know, it's still a currency. You know, it's not called, I mean, unless I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, Eric, is it called the crypto market? It's called cryptocurrency. It's currency. We're gonna make a killing on a currency. I don't know. I never heard anybody ever say to me, "Hey, how do I make a killing on the Swiss franc or the Korean won? Can you help me do that?" So it's tremendous optionality because of the volatility. But to me, you know, it's, you know, Bitcoin is really for somebody, in my opinion, with ice in their veins and a certain risk profile. I would never recommend it to my clients because, you see, my clients have a certain focus that I can help them with, which is called capital preservation. How does Bitcoin help you with that? It moves in and out of bull and bear markets every 2 months. But next year, next year, if we're going to say, don't take a few weeks or a few months, we know how volatile it is, I would be very surprised if Bitcoin makes you money next year. But I wouldn't be surprised if gold does.
Speaking of currencies, let's talk a little bit more about the U.S. dollar, because as you said, I agree with you that the risk of an escalation geopolitically between China and the United States is very significant. And by the way, China has the more sophisticated and more advanced hypersonic weapons, as far as I can tell. So I think this is a really interesting time. What does that mean for the U.S. dollar?
Well, I think that, you know, to me, the most important determinant of currencies ultimately are relative interest rate differentials. And so I would say that because I believe that the Fed is not going to be doing anything next year, and I know that raises a lot of eyebrows, but only because of what the markets have suddenly priced in the past little while, I think the dollar is going to come under pressure. Now, I think that if you're talking about which individual currencies, well, in a risk-off environment, which I think we're going to have next year, it will be currencies like the Swiss franc and like the Japanese yen that you probably want to have in the portfolio. The currencies that are most cyclical are going to have the toughest time, and that would include the Canadian dollar, the New Zealand dollar, Australian dollar, the Norwegian krona, the South African rand, the commodity currencies next year, I think are going to have a pretty rough year. So, you know, when you're taking a look at the U.S. dollar, there's some areas where it might do better against, but against the yen, perhaps even against the euro, against sterling, I think that it's going to struggle. And those are the dominant components of the trade-weighted index.
Well, David, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, tell us a little bit more about what you do at Rosenberg Research. You were with a private wealth firm a few years ago. You've branched off. You've got your own firm. Tell us what it's about.
Sure. Well, you know, first and foremost, we do offer a free one-month trial, and I urge everybody in the call to come on our website. Just Google Rosenberg Research, and you'll see the button right there on the front page for the free trial. And I guess, you know, what is it that we do? Well, you know, we cover the world in terms of investment strategy and economics, and always, you know, basically detective work. That's what we do. It's really always searching for what the consensus isn't looking at. That's what we want to be looking at. What isn't priced in? What should we be focused on that we're not focusing on? So I like to think that, you know, we're here to help to do people's homework for them from a macro and investment sense. You know, I would just say that I spent 25 years on the sell side, the 7 years in New York at Merrill, come to Toronto to work at Gluskin Sheff, a boutique mutual fund, for 11 years. And I could have started this business when I left New York to come back to Toronto in 2009, but I knew that I wanted to have more well-rounded experience. And I wanted to try out what is the buy side like. I've been on the sell side my whole life. And so to spend 11 years in my role as a financial economist and market strategist to spend every day with portfolio managers made me think about probabilities. It made me think about risks, and it made me think about how to look at risk-adjusted expected returns across the asset classes. It was really, I probably learned more in my time in Gluskin Sheff on the buy side than I did in my previous 25 years on the sell side about how to be disciplined in your approach. And so, you know, I just decided, great timing, 6 weeks before COVID to start Rosenberg Research, but it's really worked out seamlessly. We're still working remotely. But in answer to the question, you know, I knew that when I was at Merrill Lynch and people would send me competitors' material, it didn't cut it for me. And when I got to Gluskin Sheff and I was a consumer of everybody on Wall Street's research, it all sounded the same to me. Just all sounded the same. And a very bullish bias. And I understand that people want to hear a bullish story. And when you're on the sell side, you have to sell a positive story at nearly all times. So I just decided I've got the opportunity now to become rosy unplugged. And people to have, I just feel there's a dearth of analysis out there that is truly unbiased. And that's what I believe I have filled in that void in the marketplace with my new firm.
Well, I can't recommend Breakfast with Dave and your other publications strongly enough, so listeners, be sure to check out that free offer. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of Freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF, and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have David back on the show. Clearly, he is still on that deflation camp. I'm curious whether or not his views in terms of the defensive sector stocks and things like that potentially working next year, because that sector has truly been beaten down.
Patrick, let's dive into the post-game chart deck, which is titled Correction or Crash. Listeners, you find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, looking at page two here, we've got the S&P 500 Continuous Futures chart. What's going on here?
Right. So obviously, it's not a crash yet. This is up to date just a correction, at least by the traditional means, a 5% correction that's now done a 50% retracement of its prior rise down to that 50-day moving average like you were talking about in the market wrap at the beginning. And so far, that seems like a clear setup to be bought on dip. But what was interesting is that once you look under the hood of the market and really dig a little bit deeper, there's a much more interesting story going on beyond underneath the surface of the index. And so when we go to page three, I have the VIX, I'm just going to go through a number of these charts on equities to kind of just really take a dive into what's going on here. We have a VIX that has now jumped to a six-month high. I mean, the last time we saw the VIX in this 30 area was back at the start of the year, back in January, February. And when the VIX traditionally reaches these kind of higher elevated levels, it usually does one of two things. It either signals a great opportunity to buy the dip, or it turns into something more ominous and there's some significant tail risk emerges in the markets. On balance of probabilities, you always want to anticipate it's more probable that it is bought on dip. But it is a very sensitive moment where right now volatility is elevated and the risks are heightened. So when we move on to page four, this is where I wanted to really highlight what has been going on under the surface. And really what we continue to have is a deja vu of few years ago, where the FANG stocks, which are these big market cap behemoths wading huge into the index, are actually holding the S&P 500 market cap weighted index up much higher. And when you look at something like the same S&P 500 stocks, but equally weighted, the market correction's been much deeper, and pretty much the equal weight has given back almost all of the gains it has made since that short-term October bottom that led to this rally here. And so really the breadth has been deteriorating. This is evident in a number of other charts. And so I want to start on page 5 by looking at the New York Stock Exchange Bullish Percentage Index. And this is simply using the traditional point figure charting technique to determine all of the stocks on the NYSE, how many of them are in bull signal versus a bear signal. And what we have is over the course of the year, a continuous deterioration of the bullish percentage index, including this current breakdown has now broken almost 18-month lows in terms of this, where only 43% of stocks on the NYSE are actually giving a bull signal. And that just shows just how weak the underpinning stock market is beyond the indice that's being held up so well by those FANG stocks. Another great example of that is on page 6 when we look at the percentage of stocks on the New York Stock Exchange trading above their 50-day moving averages. We are down to 22%. That's implying 78% of stocks are actually in a downtrend based upon their the 50-day moving average. What's amazing is that usually whenever this kind of a breadth indicator gets this oversold, it often signals a buy on dip opportunity. And yet the S&P itself is only 5% off of its highs, and yet we are oversold to such a magnitude that only the coronavirus crash itself in March had anything of this magnitude. It really is a tale of how divergent these markets are.
Patrick, moving on to page 7, you're dividing the Russell 2000 by the NASDAQ 100. What's the story there?
Well, again, that's just another supporting chart of the case that I was continuing to make, which is that the NASDAQ, particularly the FANG stocks of the NASDAQ 100, continued to do incredibly well and hold up very well, while the majority of the stock market, in this case, I'm using the basket of small cap stocks, just continue to show how the NASDAQ outperforms the Russell. And this has not only been the case since the March peak, but this breakdown in the last few weeks continues to demonstrate that relative outperformance.
And moving on to page 8, we've got the Euro-US dollar cross. What's happening there?
Well, like we were talking about in the market wrap, I found it really interesting that typically we have seen in the past, more often than not, that the dollar in a risk-off cycle responds with a rally. And we usually would see some the areas like the euros actually weaken. But what is really interesting is that we have seen the opposite, or at least the dollar be non-responsive during this risk-off cycle. As we've seen in the last week when the market started to really, and oil started to get really hit, the dollar actually has been almost backfilling or retracing, in this case, the euro bouncing, and it really doesn't seem to have that much of a strong response in the currency markets. And I'm wondering whether this is just some short-term noise or whether or not the dollar will come back in line, if there's particularly if the market starts to deteriorate from here.
And moving on to page 9, you've got a crude oil chart.
Right. And so we were talking about this in the market wrap, Eric. And one of the things here that when I look at this chart, it's amazing what 5 days does. Like we basically in 5 days of that oil plunge wiped out the entire August to November market rally in oil in one fluid motion. And while, I subscribe to your view that this is overdone, it's an interesting price level to be observing oil, because along the July and August lows is arguably some support. And with us now already being close to, you know, $20+ off of the highs, this would be an interesting level to be watching whether a short-term low is established. But what I wanted to highlight here, Eric, on page 10 is the term structure. And this is something that you typically spend a lot of time thinking about in your trading. But what's really interesting is that most most of the damage in crude oil was really done at the front of the curve. And while we have seen generally the whole curve weaken during this cycle, one of the things that we've really seen is that really deep backwardation in the curve has started to flatten. And one of the interesting ways to look at it, on page 11, I have the spread between the January 2022 oil contract and the January 2024, so going a two-year spread on the term structure. The spread at one point was $17, and that has recently dropped down to $6 during this whole drop. So we've just seen a substantial flattening of that term structure. It'll be really interesting to see whether this is where it really stabilizes.
Well, Patrick, what happened was we had a huge blowout of backwardation at the front of the curve. That was being driven by fears of Cushing, Oklahoma, running out of oil. Then came the Omicron scare, and needless to say, that was all forgotten about. In fact, it was forgotten about before the Omicron scare that backwardation was starting to come out of the front of the curve. Now it's collapsed completely. We're not into contango yet, but you never know what's possible. As far as what happens from here, it's really politics, messaging, and rhetoric. I think the market is already sold off in terms of both flat price and term structure way too much, but that doesn't mean it can't sell off even more before this is over.
All right. Well, I just wanted to wrap things up here by just showing the 30-year government bond yield. And what's really interesting, when we heard David talking about this during the interview, the bond has been doing very well ever since that March low, and which is the peak in yields on this chart. And what's interesting is with this breakdown, one of the bigger questions in my mind is this, and like we were, the name of the slide deck, is this a correction or is this the beginning of something more ominous? And whether or not the market gets bought on dip, it's really interesting to see whether the long bond continues to sniff out that kind of deflation side of the story and whether we see yields head back down to 150 or 140 where we were just trading in late 2020.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. Information's on page 14 or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, today you're going to find the transcript for today's interview as well as a link to the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to a Goldman Sachs article on the oil reaction to Omicron being excessive, as well as a Bill Blaine article on outrageous predictions for 2022 look more likely than usual. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.